This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with a former anti-Vietnam movement leader about the continuing occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq.
First Obama promised us 2011. Now they're claiming 2014. How old will our children be when the last U.S. troop leaves Afghanistan? My age? I don't know.
The state of Oklahoma recently approved a ballot initiative called Question 755, or the Save Our State Constitutional Amendment.
The amendment prohibits the use of Sharia law, it prohibits the use of international law, and what it really does is once again put Muslims in this country in the target of discrimination and oppression.
Author Roger Hodge will offer a powerful critique of President Barack Obama in his new book, The Mendacity of Hope.
If you've been disappointed by what Obama has done, don't be. According to Hodge, Obama has been serving his corporate masters, not just since he was elected, but way before.
Stay with us. Michael, I hear we have an update on the Bolivian army.
Yeah, it's the damnedest thing. This is 43 years after the United States helped the Bolivian army under General Ovando and his boss, General Barrientos, who had instituted a coup against the Bolivian democratic government. 43 years later, after they helped track down and kill Che, the Bolivian army under Morales declares itself socialist.
More than socialist, Michael. It's not just socialist. What else is it?
Oh, anti-imperialist. Let me read you the statement they made. We declare ourselves to be anti-imperialists because in Bolivia, no external power should ever impose its will on us. We must act with sovereignty and live in dignity. We also declare ourselves anti-capitalist because that system is destroying Mother Earth.
You know, they've had, I think, 242 different presidents of Bolivia, most of them generals out of this killer army. This is the same army, of course, that wiped out the miners. Actually, when Che was murdered, there was an army operation against the miners because they didn't want them rising up in support of Che. Same army, and now it declares itself socialist, anti-imperialist, and anti-capitalist. We're starting to believe in miracles as we approach Christmas. Anyway. Recently, thousands took to the streets of London to protest against the invasion and continued occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. They did so as NATO leaders agreed on a strategy to, quote, withdraw, whatever that means, their troops from those countries. U.S. President Barack Obama was expected to announce an exit strategy from Afghanistan at the NATO summit in Lisbon. Instead, he postponed troop withdrawal not just to 2014, but beyond. Today, we're joined by Jerry Gordon, an attorney and the main organizer of the well-attended anti-war conference in Albany, New York, last summer. He was a leader in the anti-Vietnam movement and recently retired from the SEIU.
Jerry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Jerry, I guess the first question, Lisbon, Obama, and now we're hearing the date 2014 for Afghanistan. And who knows what's supposed to happen then. But I thought we were promised 2011. So what do you make of all this?
Well, the first thing I make of it is that even 2014, there's nothing firm about it. Obama said there in Lisbon, certainly our footprint will have been significantly reduced, but it's hard to anticipate what's going to be necessary. And I thought what was particularly significant was the comment by NATO's top civilian representative in Kabul, where he said, this is a quote, 2014 is a goal, not a guarantee. And he had predicted a week earlier that poor security in some areas could delay the pullout date. So everything is tentative, nothing is concrete, and they are pursuing what remains and what has been a so-called endless war. So I think that's what the government is doing. I think what's been obscured in all of this, we tend to forget, the U.S. government demonized Saddam Hussein after the outbreak of war. And as we all know, the government supported Saddam in the war against Iran. But what is less known is that the U.S. government supported the Taliban because their priority was a stable government in Kabul that would permit the construction of a pipeline they felt was strategically critical because the existing pipelines went north and west toward Russia, and they needed a pipeline to transport these gigantic hydrocarbon reserves. We're talking about 236 trillion cubic feet of natural gas and 60 to 200 billion gallons of oil reserves. This was all before 2001. It was planned. There's plenty of evidence to support it. There have been books. There is a long speech in the Congressional Record in 1998 about the critical importance of Afghanistan as a place for building a new pipeline that would pick up oil from a number of places and transport it to Pakistan and to the Indian Ocean. This is all geopolitical and economic. It's empire building. And it became converted into a war on terror after 9/11. It was a golden opportunity for the Bush administration. We always say that Iraq was really a war for oil. Well, Afghanistan was a war for oil and pipelines. And so all these young Americans and Afghan lives are being sacrificed for this empire building, for these strategic objectives. It's just a crime. And at the same time, there's no money to pay unemployment compensation, to prevent foreclosures and all the urgent social needs at home to put people back to work. So I think the anti-war movement needs to reiterate what it said earlier about the origins of the war and the rationale, and also to continue to educate, because we recognize that because there's no draft, only a small percentage of the population has placed Afghanistan at the top of the priority list. 2014 didn't precipitate gigantic demonstrations, unfortunately. So we just have to keep building the movement.
Jerry, as a leader of the anti-war activist in the Vietnam era, what are the challenges now of organizing an anti-war movement versus what it was like 30 or 40 years ago?
Well, I'd say the first major difference as compared was we had a mass base among the students. They were radicalizing. You remember the student strikes after Kent State and Jackson State. And we were able to build a gigantic movement, actually. Ended up with the climax was April 24th, 1971, with over 700,000 March on Washington. Labor played a role, an important role, but not a massive role. And the economic issues were not as sharp then as they are now. That's the other significant difference. I think what most of us have concluded, that what we have to do is tie the war much more to the economic crisis at home, bring the war dollars home. With the budget cuts, the states and cities and school districts squeezed and laying off massive numbers of public employees. The question is, where is the money going to come from to alleviate this problem? And one of the things we have to convince more people that this trillions of dollars for the Afghanistan war for oil and pipelines is should not be continued, and that money can be used to help to cope with the economic crisis at home.
On the ground in Afghanistan, what is really going on? I mean, they got rid of the last general, McChrystal. Now they have Petraeus. They had this counterinsurgency strategy. I just read recently that the Pentagon issued a report, well, we're doing okay in some areas, but in other areas, the Taliban still remain strong. How do they win this war? No one thinks they can ever, quote, win this war, at least no one with any sense. But what's the strategy? Is it just to, like, keep pouring in money and troops? I don't get it.
Well, Scahill just recently wrote a piece which I thought was very informative in terms of how the war is going. And he has concluded that the assessments given by our government are unduly positive in some respects. He thinks it's still going very badly. It's clearly unwinnable. That the night raids, the drone attacks, which have escalated, the destruction of many homes, just like they did during Vietnam. You destroy a city in order to save it. That this has turned off the population, that they have had some success in killing off Taliban leaders. But when they kill leaders, they get replaced, and it generates much greater recruiting among the insurgents. It's such a large territory, and it would take millions and millions of troops to really occupy it. They don't have them. They're stretched to the breaking point. He has concluded, and others, that we're just being painted rose-colored glasses pictures, and it's unreal, it's untrue. But they still feel that the strategic objectives are so important, the war has, they being the government, has to be pursued. And so they're projecting an endless war.
Jerry Gordon, what did you think of that embarrassment for the government when they had paid money to the person who they thought was one of the leaders of the Taliban and brought him into Kabul, and turned out that he was an imposter?
Of course, it was another embarrassment for the government, as so many things are these days. The corruption with Karzai and his statements, some of which are closer to the truth than the government would ever care to admit. That's another huge problem, because the whole objective here, pre-invasion, but the objective was to put in place a stable government in Kabul. And at first they thought Karzai was their guy, but it's not turned out. He has a streak of independence because he's so isolated. He's under a lot of pressure to act as independent and not as a stooge of the U.S. So these kind of things happen, but I don't think that they have much traction in the long run. I think we have tried to organize demonstrations. Well, we have organized them over the last years, and they have been relatively small. Well, the recent marches on Washington, the last two, I'm not talking about October 2nd, but the March ones in March of the last 2 years, it had like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people. So the movement is still alive and kicking. It's got a good nucleus, so a lot of people that see through all the misinformation. But the broader sectors that came together to elect Obama, while disenchanted on so many scores, still have not gotten to the point where they want to get out in the streets in huge numbers to demand an end of the war and to bring the troops home now.
Jerry, do you think that the election of Obama deflected the anti-war sentiment of the population?
There's no question about it. No question about it. He has been given a break on this. If Bush was following the same policies, and of course Obama has escalated greatly since Bush, both in terms of the amount of troops and in the drone attacks, but if Bush had been ordering these, it would be a totally different situation, including with the labor movement. We were able, when I say we, I mean U.S. law, labor against the war, was able to get the AFL-CIO to take a position, not of immediate, but of rapid withdrawal from Iraq. This was in 2005. That was a historic breakthrough because the AFL-CIO had not taken positions against the Vietnam War or against U.S. foreign policy. That was axiomatic. You don't challenge your government when it comes to foreign policy. But that has not happened so far with Afghanistan, although there are increasing voices within the labor movement for a break with that policy and for coming out strongly against the war, even though they're very protective of Obama. Our biggest problem right now in the movement is, in terms of constituencies, we do not have a mass base. We have plenty of organizations, plenty of activists, and plenty of smaller groups who do good work. But in terms of a mass base, so the students, it's the labor movement, it's the religious community.
What about the fact of the draft, Jerry? Does that weigh a lot, you think, in the fact that we don't have a mass movement?
Absolutely. If we had a draft in place, and I'm certainly not advocating it, it would be a whole different thing. It would be Vietnam all over again. But we don't. And as many critics have pointed out, only 1% or 2% of the U.S. population is directly involved in the sense of loss of lives, of family members, loved ones, So there's not the level of opposition that you would have thought after a war that has gone on entering, what, its ninth year.
What do you think the next steps are for people like us and our listening audience who are opposed to the war in Afghanistan? And how can we reach you and your organization? Do you have a website?
Well, first I want to say I'm honored to be on the same program with Heidi and Michael and Michael, who are very important figures in the movement. And I think all of us share the hope that we can finally break through and convert what we have now into a massive movement. And I think that the key remains to tie it to the economy. We've got this jobless recovery, so-called, and the problems are deepening. The states and cities, you know, must balance budgets, unlike the federal government. Now we have this deficit commission, which wants to cut $6 trillion in benefits. Everything is imploding in this country. The crackdowns are taking place, the FBI raids. And so it's a very fluid situation. We see just today gigantic demonstrations of students against tuition increases in Great Britain. And hopefully this will spread. What's going to happen predictably is greater struggle by students, by workers on their issues. And we have to relate that to the war. So it's an educational job. I see that as being the main focus, bring the war dollars home.
How do we get in touch with you?
You can write me to National Assembly, that's N-A-T Assembly at AOL.com, or you can call me, 216-382-4597.
And is there a website for the?
NATassembly.org.
Got it.
Jerry, we really appreciate your work. I mean, there's so few people out there doing it, so thank you very much.
Keep your spirits up and keep up your good work.
Well, thank you so much. And Michael and Heidi, keep up your good work. I know you will.
Jerry is also one of the lead organizers of the April 9th Get Out of Afghanistan Now demonstration in New York.
If you love this land of the free, bring them home, bring them home. Bring them back from overseas, bring them home, bring them home. It'll make the politicians sad, I know. Bring them home, bring them home. They want to tangle with their foe. Bring them home, bring them home. They want to test the grand theory. Bring them home, bring them home. With the blood of you and me. Bring them home, bring them home. We'll give no more brave young lives. Bring them home, bring them home. For the gleam in someone's eyes. Bring them home, bring them home.
In November, 70% of Oklahoma voters approved a ballot initiative, Question 755, or Save Our State, a constitutional amendment which bans Sharia from being considered in Oklahoma courts. The ballot says that Oklahoma courts must, quote, rely on federal and state law when deciding cases, and forbids them from considering or using international law, and from considering or using Sharia law. Recently, Munir Awad, executive director of CARE Oklahoma, filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of State Question 755, and an Oklahoma City judge extended a temporary ban on implementation of this constitutional amendment. U.S. District Judge Vicki Miles LaGrange said that she will rule after weighing all of the issues. Munir Awad, who is Muslim, says the amendment demonizes his faith. Munir joins us today.
Munir, we were actually sitting in the studio when we got notice that Oklahoma had passed this ballot initiative, Question 755, the so-called Save Our State constitutional amendment, which banned Sharia law as well as other laws from being considered in Oklahoma courts. I know you're involved in litigation in it, but can you first tell us, what does this initiative say?
Basically, what it does is it labeling Islam as somehow a unique threat to Oklahoma courts. This is what the amendment literally says. This language is about making sure Sharia is not considered in Oklahoma courts. And the authors of this amendment, those who campaigned for it and promoted voting yes for it, those people had a clear and specific message that Islam was a threat to Oklahoma. That's what this said. At this point, now that the battle is in the courtroom, these same authors are having a hard time articulating what this amendment is for. For instance, our last hearing, the judge asked the defendants over and over again, what is the purpose of this amendment? And they had a hard time articulating that. So clearly before the elections, it was all about targeting Islam as a threat to Oklahoma. And now I think people are seeing how problematic that reasoning is.
And that, I guess, relates to my question. How did this even arise? Did something happen that these individuals responded to?
Just came out of, for us sitting here in, of course, cosmopolitan New York, it came out of the blue.
I think what happened is a handful of politicians realized that Islamophobia is politically popular. I really think the wave of anti-Islamic or Islamophobic sentiments in America now are much higher than ever before.
Yeah, we share that view also.
The politician that authored this, he's just he's had a history of conflicts with the Muslim community in Oklahoma. This is someone who encouraged Oklahomans to ban Muslim women from wearing headscarves and driver's license photos. This is a man who publicly refused a centennial gift of a Quran, but not just refused it, but made a public comment that he doesn't think Oklahomans should respect the religion that condones violence against women, something that's totally false. But this is someone who's had some anti-Islamic sentiments in the past. His history is filled with it, and he knew that he could score politically by attacking Muslims.
Is there any instance that you could relate to us where Sharia law would be applicable in an Oklahoma court?
Well, many, just in the same relation that other religions are applicable. I mean, there's many people that do Islamic arbitration outside of courts, and they expect the courts to enforce that, and a judge can decide whether to enforce those agreements or arbitration decisions. In my case specifically, I have a Sharia-compliant will. In order for my will to be probated, a judge is going to have to look at the aspects of my faith that, in regards to devising my property.
This is the same under any law, right? It's not just Sharia. I mean, it's different.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a person with a will that refers to aspects of Jewish traditions can have that probated in a court. All these things are in accordance to the law of the land. Islamic marriages are in accordance to the law of the land. Islamic financing in accordance to the law of the land. My will is written in accordance to the law of the land. But specifically for the reason that it mentions Islam, that is the only reason Oklahoma will invalidate my will.
Let me ask you, when this campaign was going, first, what was the vote like on the final initiative? And secondly, what kind of political messages were being given out by both sides, if we talk about sides in this?
Well, with respect to the political messages, it was a clear Islamophobic fear-mongering campaign for voting yes to this. I mean, there were politicians, a very small handful, that had the backbone and the legal knowledge to understand this should not be on our ballot. There was a handful, I can count them on one hand, how many politicians didn't vote to put this on the ballot. Those politicians were attacked during the campaigns as being people that wanted to bring Sharia to Oklahoma so terrorists can use Islamic law in our courts. That was specifically
amazing.
It's so crazy.
It sounds crazy, but I agree with you about the context. The context in this country is, you know, of course, you're Muslim, but I, from observing it from at the Center for Constitutional Rights, what happens immediately after 9/11 and, of course, sometimes before, but certainly after, it's been an incredible assault on Muslims and Muslim faith. There's no question this is part of it.
Not only was it fear-mongering, but it was misinformation. They were just outright lies about Islam, legally false ideas that Islamic law can take over an Oklahoma court, which is just ridiculous. And then these politicians basically told Oklahomans, if we don't act now, our state will be in peril. We have to vote yes in order to save our state. Even to this day, there are Oklahomans. Today there was an editorial in a local paper where someone admittedly said, you know, I didn't know much about this. I just knew I was being told if I didn't vote yes, Islam was going to take over our courts. So there are people that were grossly misinformed, but, you know, they're really not to blame as much as the politicians who misinformed them. There are politicians that deliberately misinform people, deliberately lie to people in order to gain political popularity at the polls.
Munir, talk to us a bit about what kind of public education campaigns have happened as a result of this to counter those mistruths.
Well, CAIR, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, worked before the elections. We conducted a campaign, Vote No to State Question 755, where we had some materials. We also went out to universities. We went out to churches. We had a heavy hand in a lot of interfaith work, reaching out to people and talking to them about why this amendment is, one, unconstitutional, why it offends Muslims, and why it is a risk to all of Oklahoma, which is what it was. I know the Muslim population here is less than 1%. The number of those who are registered voters is far lesser than that. And we still had 30% of registered voters that voted that day vote no to this. So there are people that know better. I'm not saying that they knew this because of our campaign. I mean, this is almost common sense to someone that has any knowledge in Islam or the Constitution. That was basically our campaign. It was more of a grassroots style. We're still conducting that campaign. We have a lot of speaking engagements at interfaith workshops, at churches, at universities. We still do that. Unfortunately, it took a lawsuit, though, to sort of bring light to this situation nationally and even internationally. The lawsuit has brought much more attention to this. And again, these same authors of this amendment that had so much anti-Islamic and ignorant comments about Islam before the elections have almost disappeared now. They realize that their words were detrimental to their own perception and to this amendment. What we see now is that the political campaign that was behind this was all about the elections, and those voices are sort of quieting down. We've had Oklahomans that have heard about this through the lawsuit and through the media who have reached out to our office. I mean, overwhelmingly, the outpour of support for Oklahomans that were embarrassed by this, that are telling us they're happy that we're working to sort of reverse this. Our office alone, where the Council on American Islamic Relations, has received more donations from non-Muslims in the past 2 weeks than we have from Muslims. There are a number of non-Muslim Oklahomans who are concerned about State Question 755 and the perception and the effects it has on Oklahoma, and they're supporting our cause now to sort of make sure that that doesn't become a part of our Constitution.
Let's talk about the lawsuit, and specifically about the judge who imposed a temporary restraining order. What is the next step?
Right now, the restraining order was extended for 7 more days, just so that the judge can have time to make an order about whether to issue a preliminary injunction or not. So we're very hopeful. We feel positive that we've made an argument worthy to have a preliminary injunction issued. The preliminary injunction would basically hold this amendment from being certified until a final determination is made. The standards you have to meet in the courtroom are all in reference to the likelihood to succeed. And I think the judges realize that the case we've made, there's a strong likelihood to succeed on the merits of the case. We're comfortable with letting the courts determine whether this is constitutional or not. Throughout American history, it's taken the courts to step in whenever the mass majority of people chose to do something that was unconstitutional. There's nothing wrong with this tradition. You know, we're grateful to be a part of this tradition. We're grateful that the Council on American Islamic Relations is part of this tradition, that a civil liberties group has stood up and spoke up in order for the courts to ensure that our Constitution is followed.
I remember years ago, 1968 in Paris, there was a huge uprising of students, and one of those students was a German student named Rudi Deutschke, who was a leader of SDS in Germany, and the French government attacked him because he was Jewish and he was a leftist, and they threw him out of the country, and the students got into the streets the next day and they held up signs saying, "We're all German Jews." Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of solidarity that you got from a huge group of people out in Oklahoma, and it's very heartening to hear it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's really made our work much easier because, we really want to believe that we're doing this for the better of Oklahoma. It is amazing odds to go against when you're being painted as someone that's trying to reverse the will of the people. And we're just trying to remind people, you know, this isn't a reasonable conclusion people made after a lot of thought and reasonable research. This was people that were misled by politicians that have lied to us. When Oklahomans realize that there is something greater that we can work for and that this isn't too late to reverse, everyone is watching Oklahoma now. So it's important for as many Oklahomans as possible to get behind this movement and campaign to make sure the politicians that misled us are held accountable for this, and also to make sure this doesn't become a part of our Constitution.
Are there other individuals who are focusing on the international ban? In other words, right. It's not just Sharia law, it's also international law. Has that been a topic among other organizations and people?
Yes, when we filed this lawsuit immediately, we had a lot of people get in touch with us that were saying, you know, we've been considering a lawsuit ourselves. We're really concerned about not only the religious issues, but international law. And I've tried to point that out to many people as well. I'm saying, you know, as a Muslim, working with a Muslim civil liberties organization, I felt compelled to file this lawsuit. However, there are international law concerns here. One, with respect to Oklahoma, our economy. There's thousands of international businesses located in Oklahoma, and we have Oklahoma-based companies that have international relations with other companies. This amendment says that all international agreements will be invalid.
What do you mean? If there's a contract between a company in Oklahoma and, say, a company in Portugal, and you want to enforce some aspect of international law in a court in Oklahoma, you can't do it?
Absolutely. I mean, this choice of law issues... A judge is not allowed to consider that in Oklahoma if this amendment becomes law.
Is that in the lawsuit as well, or is your lawsuit...
No, that's not. That has more to do with the legal complications. Me, I had to file a lawsuit for what I would have standing for, and I would have had a hard time showing that I had standing under international contract. So, there are people, though, that are considering other aspects of international law. You know, I wouldn't be able to show my marriage contract will be invalid.
They're not going to recognize the marriage, is what you're saying, because it was made in Canada under international law, supposedly.
Yeah. The amendment is poorly written. It was overwhelming how broad this amendment is. It reaches far beyond the intention the politicians had, but it just really shows the narrow-mindedness of their focus. This was a campaign to attack Muslims in order to get people to the polls. But what they've done is they put the entire state of Oklahoma at risk.
One of the interesting points you made is how when you raise this issue of Sharia or Muslim law or Muslims in general, how no matter how stupid and ridiculous the law is, that politicians run the other way because they're so afraid of being touched by the fact that they might want to do something that's reasonable in favor, so-called in favor of a Muslim in some way. It's really a very serious situation, actually.
It is. I know our office in particular, we reached out to a number of people before these elections, and understandably or not, a lot of people were not willing to put their neck out there or join us or listen to what we had to say. But coincidentally, as soon as we began to have a few victories in the courtroom, there have been people that have been coming out. And the few politicians that had the backbone to stand up to this, hopefully they'll be able to shine under this as an example of what other politicians should do around the states. Because I know there are people such as Newt Gingrich who are telling people to look at Oklahoma and see what we should do federally or across many states.
Do you have a website that people can go to?
We do. It's careoklahoma.com, but they can also follow Care Oklahoma on Facebook or on Twitter. Care Oklahoma.
Perfect.
Great.
So I appreciate and I love the show.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Now I could refuse it. In an attack from the left, former editor-in-chief of Harper's Magazine, Roger Hodge, offers a powerful critique of President Barack Obama in his new book, The Mendacity of Hope, Barack Obama and the Betrayal of American Liberalism. President Obama has served the interests of his corporate masters, Hodge demonstrates. And he draws a list of examples, such as cheerleading globalization, designing a health care plan where insurance companies make a killing, extrajudicial assassinations of American citizens, boundless state secrecy, and unlimited corporate bailouts.
Roger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Roger Hodge, you've written a book called The Mendacity of Hope, Barack Obama and the Betrayal of American Liberalism. Why the title?
Well, obviously, it's a play on the audacity of hope, and the term mendacity suggested itself not only because of Obama's now proven propensity to say one thing and do another, but also because his most enthusiastic supporters have really been lying to themselves. Part of the focus is a critique of the Obama administration's policies, but part of it is an argument against this tendency that so many people have to deny what's going on right in front of them and to be so attached to their hopes and their dreams and what they wish were happening. There's a double game going on with the title.
When we introduced you, you haven't heard your introduction, but we said, all you people who think you're disappointed in Obama, you never should have expected anything. And that's what I think when I read your book that I really got out of it. And that's what you're really saying to people. And why don't you just describe what you're saying by that we shouldn't be disappointed. We should have just been smarter.
Naomi Klein calls it a sloppy intellectual culture that willed this political chimera into being. That's exactly the point, I think. Talk to us about that.
When Obama first began to emerge as a candidate, we ran a piece in Harper's by Ken Silverstein, who a great investigative reporter who was our Washington editor, who argued that, look, this guy is a conventional machine Democrat. He came to Washington, and he set up business like any conventional Democrat would. He set up shop. He said, okay, come to me with your problems, corporate America, and I will try to solve them. And
that's exactly right.
You look at that, you listen to this inspiring rhetoric. If you look at it on paper, it's kind of empty. There wasn't a lot of content there. We were never fooled. I was never fooled. I was never a fan. I voted for him because I didn't really see much alternative. I'm not a registered Democrat, so I didn't get to choose in the primary. I think I probably would have voted for him in the primary, just on lesser evilism. But there was no reason to believe, in my view, that there was any chance that this person was going to come to Washington and clean it up.
Well, let me ask you about the lesser evilism, because you make the point in your book that in some respects Obama is the greater evil, and you point out the stance that his administration has taken on certain constitutional rights. They've actually pushed the Supreme Court further to the right than it was when Bush left office.
Yeah.
So why do you say he's the lesser evil?
Well, I meant the lesser evil of between Obama and Hillary. I'm an independent, but if I were a Democrat, I probably would have voted for Obama. Now, when it comes to Obama being better or worse than the McCain-Palin administration, I think it's kind of, there's an argument to be made that constitutionally we might be better off under the Republicans, because then the Democrats would at least be opposing these unconstitutional usurpations of authority. It's an interesting conversation to have, and I'm not really sure where I fall down on that, but I do think that it's hard to imagine that it would be any worse in terms of civil liberties under McCain.
Who are the corporate interests? Identify them in terms of the people that backed Obama initially and the ones that are feeding at the trough now.
The straightforward fire sector, I think, is the biggest block.
Fire means?
Fire meaning finance, insurance, and real estate. If you look at Obama's major backers in the 2008 campaign, the number one corporate backer was Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, this is a great page. It's actually page 45 of your book, and this book is called The Mendacity of Hope, Barack Obama and the Betrayal of American Liberalism. It's by Roger Hodge, and if you really want to figure out what's went on and what's going on, get this book, and it's easy to get through. I mean, it's quite well written. Anyway, this list here is fabulous. Goldman Sachs, as you were saying, is number one corporate backer. Is that right?
That's right. Goldman Sachs, I mean, I'm excluding the universities because that's a complex case. I should point out that under American law, at least so far, at the moment, corporations can't donate directly, as you all know, obviously. But when I say that Goldman was his number one corporate backer, that's a collective backer, because the employees of Goldman Sachs are the ones who are making those investments.
Let's contrast that with McCain. McCain, I think your book says, got less than $250,000 or something from...
McCain raised so much less money than Obama. And he got money from some of the same people, but just a fraction, really, of what Obama took in. Goldman collectively gave Obama almost $1 million, but invested only $230,000 with McCain. McCain's top backer really didn't even give very much compared to Obama's backers. And so Obama's backers also included people like Morgan Stanley, who's pretty far down the list. Citigroup's way up there with $700,000. J.P. Morgan Chase with almost $700,000. You have the big media companies, the big lobby shops like Sidley Austin. You have UBS, Skadden Arps, IBM, Microsoft, Google are way up there. So what you have really are the high flyers. These are the big guns, the big corporations in the American economy who have a lot of money to play with when it comes to politics. They don't do this out of the goodness of their hearts. They don't mobilize, these companies don't mobilize their employees because they're civic minded. They expect to get something. And as we saw in the bailouts, in the rolling bailouts, the financial sector got a tremendous return on investment. Although they got their feelings hurt when Obama called them fat cats. then when it comes around to the 2010 midterms, even though they were mad at Obama, they still gave him a lot of money. I mean not him, the Democrats. The Democrats still brought in a lot of money. And now with the implementation of the Dodd-Frank financial reform, so-called, it's really just an orgy of lobbying to try to shape the regulations that have to be written that came out of that bill.
Well, Roger Hodge, that kind of demonstrates your point that the Democratic Party, starting probably in the 70s, has really changed its nature. It's no longer what it was during the New Deal.
One thing I'll just quote from that, what you say in the book. You say, Obama and the current Democratic leadership represent the perfection of the long right turn the party took beginning in the 1970s. That's what Michael's asking, and tell us about it.
What we saw is that the Democrats, is that a faction among the Democrats, and Joe Biden was a big part of that story, so was Bill Clinton, decided that if they were going to compete for power with the Republicans, they needed to do a better job of cultivating the business community. That the old New Deal constituencies weren't going to cut it anymore. And they moved right. They just set up their Democratic Leadership Council and created think tanks and set out to prove that they were really a better business party than the Republicans were. Under Clinton, we saw it. You know, the Clinton, appropriated all kinds of policy objectives from the Republicans and really set the stage for the financial crisis that we're still living through by deregulating finance, by breaking down the old New Deal protections, repealing the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, and deregulating derivatives with the Commodities Futures Modernization Act. The old idea, which is unfortunately still with us, that the Democrats are the liberal party, that they are the party of the common man, who are fighting the big business bad guys in the Republican Party, is really a myth, and it's a pernicious myth.
You say in the book that Obama came into office and he was put in and actually succeeded in burying liberalism, or quote something like that from the book. And then you talk about health care, which I think hadn't actually passed at the time you wrote the book.
Right.
But you begin to give some perspectives on what you think might happen. Why don't you talk about what you think now of the legislation, whether Obama had better options than that, and what he should have done?
I'm very critical in the book of the health care legislation because I think it is, in effect, a bailout of the insurance industry. And there were other options. I don't think that, there was the public option, which was much discussed. I think Obama and his team always saw that as a bargaining chip. They never really planned on pushing that through. The problem with the Health Care Act is that it doubles down on the most irrational elements of our system. If we're moving towards universal coverage, the role of insurance companies is obsolete, and so they essentially just become this parasite that's skimming profit out of the system, contributing to the inflation of health care costs.
I think that's right. I mean, what's the purpose of insurance companies other than to collect money for themselves? Why
exactly.
Do we need
it? I worked for an insurance company when I got I talk about this a little bit in the book. When I first got out of college, it was 9 very grim months. And it was.
I work for one also.
And I was an adjuster, which is horrible Orwellian job. My job was to deny claims. I had any excuse you had. I mean, and there were plenty of loopholes and technicalities that you could use to deny coverage. That was my job. It was never told to me that was my job, but that was clearly the implication. And it's that's the case to a greater or lesser extent with all insurance companies. They want to ration coverage because they want to keep the money in-house. It's simple. It's insurance is a bet that you enter into with a company. Now, if healthcare is a strange context for insurance because everyone gets sick, everyone dies. If everyone is covered, a company is going to have a hard time making money. So they're going to try to figure out a way to deny the claims. So I have people, good friends in my life, who have excellent health care coverage, supposedly, but who are fighting insurance companies just to get basic procedures done to eliminate unbearable pain that no one denies that they have. So having health insurance does not guarantee health care. And so the idea that Obama has and the Democrats have done this historic deed and given us all the thing that we've been fighting for 40 years is really kind of outrageous, incredibly frustrating, because we're going to have this fight again.
Roger, you actually sort of sum it up in talking about health care by saying the health bill is of a piece with Obama's general approach to governance, which is to make loud, dramatic claims about his purportedly reformist agenda, claims that both his supporters and his enemies almost always take at face value, while working behind the scenes to ensure that no major stakeholder in his coalition of corporate backers will suffer significant losses.
Yeah.
And that could sum up most of what he's done.
Yeah, that was an outstanding passage in the book, I thought.
Thank you. Yeah, we see it again and again. And we see it with detention.
Guantanamo.
We
State
see it with
secrets.
Afghanistan. We see it with Iraq. Supposedly the war in Iraq is over. And people take that as face value. Oh, he ended the war in Iraq. Well, he didn't.
Yeah. Right. He just said he did.
Could you talk just for a minute about the people Barack has surrounded himself with, Rahm Emanuel, how that shouldn't have been a surprise to people?
Well, it was a very clear signal at the beginning of the administration when he put Emmanuel in as chief of staff. I mean, this guy, he's a money man. He made his reputation raising money for Bill Clinton and working for the Daily Machine in Chicago. This is a guy who has no principles. He's all about winning, and he's all about raising money. Now, you could say, oh, well, at least he's tough. But he didn't fight for anything that was worth fighting for. Then you have Lawrence Summers, who was at the table in the Clinton years, as I mentioned, when the financial protections what remained of the financial protections of the New Deal were gutted. A president surrounds himself with people who are illiberal, who are completely compromised by their connections with Wall Street, and people shouldn't be surprised when those agendas that we associate with these figures are then put in place.
Well, let me ask you now in the area of solutions, Roger. Imagine we fast forward a year and a half from now. Obama's running again, and let's say he's running against Sarah Palin, or let's say he's running against Cheney's daughter. It doesn't matter for the purposes of my question. You going to vote for Obama again, or are you going to urge some different kind of alternative?
Well, I hope that he sees a primary challenge. First of all, it could be clarifying. Those of us who disagree with Obama's policies have to make a credible threat. We have to gain some leverage over our representatives in government. And if liberals just continue to vote for Democrats no matter what they do, in election after election after election, just cave in, we're never going to have any real influence. So at some point, we have to draw a line and say, I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm not going to support this corruption. I'm not going to support this unconstitutional behavior. And every election is an emergency, it seems. There's never a time when the Democrats are going to be worse than the Republicans. It's a real double bind when we come into another presidential election, whether we withhold our ballots, vote for third-party candidates, or just suck it up and go through the motions again. I don't have an easy answer to that, but I do think that this midterm was a wake-up call because a lot of people just didn't show up. A lot of people didn't vote. The youth vote was much lower. Working class Democrats were discouraged and they didn't go to the ballot. And then the independents switched. A lot of independents who previously supported Obama and the Democrats voted for Republicans. If Palin is running against him, I don't know if I can vote for him again right now.
Roger, the Mendacity of Hope has received much critical acclaim. Are you working on another writing project?
Not yet. I've been working as hard as I can to get the word out about this book. I've been doing writing that is related to the book, a lot of op-eds. Writing the book is only half the story. You have to get out and make sure people find out about it because there's so much noise in the culture. There's so many books. It's not necessarily a welcome message for a lot of people. People don't want to reckon with the sheer awfulness of our political culture. And the persuasive enterprise doesn't stop when the book gets printed.
Well, Roger, we're really a privilege and honored to be able to help you get the message out about your book. Roger D. Hodge, The Mendacity of Hope, Barack Obama and the Betrayal of American Liberalism. Get the book.
It's a great book.
It really did a good job.
Fabulous.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks
for being
on
Law and Disorder.
Great to
meet
you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Roger. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.